Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the offhand remark by Secretary of State John Kerry that the Assad regime could avoid an American strike if they handed over their chemical weapons arsenal to the international community in the next week, a suggestion the Russians have run with that the Syrian foreign minister quickly endorsed. Edward Luttwak, a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, joins us to discuss this sudden turn of events and his recent article in the New York Times, "In Syria, America Loses If Either Side Wins." Then we will speak with award-winning investigative journalist Max Blumenthal, who is in Ramallah, Palestine, having just visited the vast Syrian refugee camp in Jordan. We will discuss the appalling conditions the traumatized refugees live under and the fate of the many thousands more Syrian refugees just across the border who are prevented from entering Jordan. An opponent of U.S. intervention, Max Blumenthal, was repeatedly told by the refugees that they want America to bomb Assad, even if it costs them their homes and livelihoods. Then finally, we'll speak with Todd O'Boyle, the program director at the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause, who was in the conservative-dominated U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit today as judges heard an appeal by Verizon that challenges the FCC's statutory authority and their open internet rules in a critical case that will decide the future of net neutrality in America. And joining us now is Edward Luttwak, who is a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He served as a consultant to the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Council, the United States Department of State, and branches of the military. He's the author of Strategy, the Logic of War and Peace, and his latest book is The Rise of China versus the Logic of Strategy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward Luttwak.
Hello.
So your recent article, it's titled "In Syria, America Loses If Either Side Wins." Do you still, hold by the basic point there, which sort of reminds me somewhat of what Henry Kissinger said about the Iran-Iraq war? It's a pity both sides can't lose. And whether that has been the U.S. strategy or the reality on the ground, you've advocated the continuation of that. But clearly, things are reaching a point, boiling point, if you will. What do you make of this Russian offer?
Well, I think the Russian offer should be accepted straight out, because any argument anybody I've heard anybody's made for bombing of Syria is an argument that the Russian offer completely overturns, because if we go with the Russian offer, we achieve that purpose much better. One argument, of course, is to punish the Assad regime for having used chemical weapons, leaving aside, the argument that it was really the rebels who did it and so on. And that argument of punishment, well, whatever the bombing that we could do and would deprive Assad of a certain number of these chemical weapons, do much less than what the Russians are proposing, which is international, but in fact, American-Russian joint identification on the ground, location, removal, and destruction of all his chemical weapons. So bombing would destroy some, and this Russian proposal might miss a few, but certainly would eliminate far more. So it would be a far better solution, and if you like to think of it as a punishment, a far stronger punishment.
Well, in terms of the idea that both sides, the policy is that you want both sides to lose, it seems to me that the president dug himself into a rhetorical trap by issuing the red line, and then the unexpected happened, which was the regime's use of chemical weapons. And now you have the Russian proposal that might begin to eliminate them. Do you think that the Secretary of State, John Kerry, also dug a rhetorical trap for himself in this offhanded remark in London, where he suggested that the Syrians could get rid of all, in a verified way, get rid of all of the chemical stockpiles? That has led his own spokesperson, Jen Psaki, to describe that more as a rhetorical exercise than a proposal, but it looks like both the Russians and the Syrians are running with it.
Well, the fact is that President Obama has been poorly served by his own overactive officials. He himself made it clear in every possible way for more than 2 years that he views Assad's enemies as dangerous or more dangerous than the Assad regime. And therefore he, Obama, refused to get engaged. He was bombarded by all these, overactive columnists and too many of his own officials. Left in the NSC, by Samantha and so on, and telling him, do something, the do something crowd, who don't even feel called upon to specify what they want done or why and so on. Well, he resisted this very firmly. And then when he said that the use of chemical weapons would be the red line, that was actually his own way of resisting it, because the message to Assad was, don't use chemical weapons, you're doing well enough without them. And then this horrible episode happened, 1,400 people got killed. I personally am more or less convinced that it was done by the rebels precisely to trigger an American action, but that's neither here nor there. The thing is that Kerry has also been an overactive official, hot and vehement as compared to Obama's cool restraint. And so Obama is now besieged by his own appointees, and makes the predicament even worse, which is he has now had to gamble the authority of his administration on Congress voting in favor of a military action that he, Obama, would certainly have opposed if he were still a congressman. Obama is asking them to do something he wouldn't do himself if he was a congressman. So this is a three-way predicament. And now comes the Russian offer. The Russian offer is, don't need to bomb, great. Instead, we inspect, remove all chemical weapons. That achieves the purpose in regard to Iran. And it achieves the subtext purpose, which is to intimidate Iran. You punish Syria and you intimidate Iran, and much more effectively, because you create the precedent of Americans and Russians working together to identify and remove offending items. Of course, it's the nuclear stuff in Iran's case. So I've heard many arguments for bombing of Syria. All of them are satisfied by the Russian offer, except one, and that is, you actually want to bomb Syria to eliminate the Assad regime. Thank you very much. That would be to install the caliphate crowd, the Salafists, the jihadis, the Al-Qaeda, who are, every day manifest themselves. Just the other day, the Italian journalist was released. It turns out he had not been kidnapped by the government, but by the rebels, and the rebels were a bunch of very dangerous fanatics.
Well, and they just captured a Christian town, Malula, which is, I think, the last place on the planet where people speak Aramaic, the language of the Bible.
Almost the last place. There are a few other places. But in Malula, definitely what happened before is that the priests and the monks have fled. A group of beleaguered nuns were left there. They have not been killed, but the fact is that all over Syria we've had Christians attacked by rebels because they were Christian, and we've had churches destroyed by them, and so on and so forth. It's very clear who these rebels are. Originally, there may have been, 1,000 different groups with 1,000 different views, but now the ones that seem to be strong and the ones who count and the ones who would be in charge are essentially Salafists who are willing to kill fellow Muslims because they're not pious enough, and jihadis for whom winning in Syria is the beginning of fighting all the neighbors, and Al-Qaeda people for whom winning in Syria is acquiring a base to attack America. That's why President Obama very wisely didn't want to get involved. Then he got trapped by his own red line, as you pointed out, and now the Russians can untrap him. And I certainly hope he can control his own Secretary of State and his own overactive officials and simply say yes.
Again, I'm speaking with Edward Luttwak, who's a senior associate at the Center for Strategic International Studies. He served as a consultant to the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Council, the U.S. Department of State, and branches of the military. He's the author of Strategy, The Logic of War and Peace, and his latest book is The Rise of China Versus the Logic of Strategy. Now, why do you think, though, that the Syrians, I imagine the answer is they don't want to be bombed, but didn't they build this very, very substantial chemical arsenal as their poor man's deterrent against Israel's nuclear weapons?
That is true, but that was the poor man's deterrent. But Israel is not threatening them. Israel is not threatening to bomb Syria. It's the United States that is threatening to bomb Syria. So the nuclear arsenal that was acquired as a counterbalance to the Israeli air superiority is now serving that, not at all serving that purpose, and instead it is endangering them. And so it makes perfect sense for the Syrians to accept the Russian offer, but beyond that, as you well know, as we all know, the Syrians entirely depend on Russian strategic and diplomatic support. So Russians have made the offer, the Syrians simply cannot refuse. And this is great because it means that it saves us from the disastrous engagement in, you know, an attack on Syria this time, which is enormously costly enterprise for the United States as it is still trying to disengage from these wars.
So does this mean, though, that the Russians, unlike a lot of the critics of Obama's impending military strike, both on the left and the right, and as you know, the American people are overwhelmingly against it, and the Congress is at this point not likely to vote for it, the arguments are that it'll just dig the hole deeper and inflame the region even further. But it would seem to me that the fact that the Russians want this outcome would indicate that they think that an American strike might actually work. Is that a reasonable?
Well, for the Russians, the argument is a somewhat different one, and that is that in their diminished circumstances in the world, they're not able to prevent the United States from bombing Syria. But if they're not able to do it, so once the United States would bomb Syria, their weakness would thereby be exposed. And it is very bad for Russia to have its inability to protect its only ally cruelly exposed. The Russian proposal avoids that. Now, at the same time, the Russians are very aware of the fact that the Assad regime does not need chemical weapons in order to resist the rebels. Indeed, in the last 2 years of fighting up and down, it has not, of course, generally used them. It has not used them. And now there's a controversy whether, in fact, they were used in this one time, which I personally don't believe is the case, because why would Assad deliberately court an American attack once he, you know, given that he was, you know, given a free ride, more or less, if he didn't use chemical weapons? Doesn't make sense to me. Much more likely a rebel provocation, but be that as it may, for the Russians, their offer is a way to get out from an impossibly embarrassing position, to be seen unable to protect their only ally in the world.
But Edward Ludwig, when you say that the rebels are likely to your mind, are likely to be behind this chemical attack, where would they have gotten these weapons from, given that...
Well, because at this point, quite a few Assad regime, or if you like, Syrian bases have fallen to the rebels, they've captured warehouses, they've captured depots, they've captured all kinds of things, and it would be passing strange if they hadn't also captured, some chemical weapons.
So the case that the U.S. is making through intercepts of the 400-unit 450 and Brigade 155, all of that stuff is disinformation?
No, I don't want to accuse, other people of... falsehood, disinformation, deception. I just point to the fact that the Assad regime has been holding its own, did not seem to need to use chemical weapons, and the Assad regime was under straight warning from the U.S. that from Obama, if you're going to use chemical weapons, I will bomb you. And therefore, they had every possible reason not to use chemical weapons. It doesn't make sense for them to have used chemical weapons. And therefore, even if they were definitely used, and either the rebels did it, and the communication intercepts were simply mistaken, may have referred to something else. You know, mistakes do occur, especially in secret matters of this sort. But in addition to that, there is a possibility that it was simply unauthorized. That is to say, it was done by somebody who was in Assad regime uniform, but whose intention, as been the case for many people in Assad regime, is that he was a traitor. The guy who ordered this attack, who was intercepted ordering it, may well have worn the uniform, but did not reflect the Assad regime policy or its desires or wishes, but it was in fact a treasonable act, to betraying the regime. There's been a lot of these betrayals, a lot of desertions. Quite a few of the rebels, of course, were, you know, officers of the regime who defected, an enlisted man, and so on. So it's perfectly, there are many explanations other than deliberate deception by dishonest intelligence officers.
Well, but the reason that the, I think the bulk of the information and the bulk of the belief, which is what the administration is putting forth, is that it was the Assad regime, is simply because they are in possession of so much of it. They've integrated into their military in a way that I don't get.
Yeah, but I mean, an Assad regime, we've had Assad regime ministers defecting, Assad regime generals defecting, Assad regime colonels defecting. Any of them could have ordered the new chemical attack with the deliberate intention of triggering an American bombing against the regime. We've had numerous such betrayals, mm-hmm. and that would provide, assuming intelligence is entirely correct, and assuming, as I do, that there was no deliberate falsehood or deception, there's still a perfectly good explanation. Yes, it was an official who, an Assad regime official did it, but he did it in order to get the Assad regime in trouble. And since, as I say, there have been so many defectors, so many generals, ministers, colonels, and so on, have defected and have attacked the regime, this is not at all far-fetched. But in any event, the Russian offer makes all of this moot, because far better to remove all the chemical weapons from Syria than to bomb some of them at enormous price, political price, for the United States, yet, you know, starting yet another war, domestic diversion of domestic attention for the president and his administration, the provocation of Russia, slapping Russia in the face by attacking its only ally. I mean, there's 17 arguments against bombing Syria. And there were a couple four, and these couple four have been overtaken and overturned by the Russian offer, which is much better than those arguments would have been.
So at the end of the day, Edward Luttwak, Kerry's slip of the tongue, as far as you're concerned, is salvation. It gets the U.S.
Yes,
off the hook.
Kerry's slip of the tongue should become U.S. policy. The Russians have made an offer that only a fool would refuse, and we should not be fools. And President Obama gets out of this cruel predicament of him having to gamble his authority as U.S. president on Congress voting for something that he would never vote for if he were still a senator. This is a really absurd predicament, an excessive predicament, and he gets out of it by accepting the Russian offer. There's nothing wrong with the Russian offer. It's all right, none of it is wrong, except for those people who in reality did not want to act because of the chemical weapons, but it was really an excuse to take down the Assad regime, because they, unlike me, have view with favor the arrival of Salafis, jihadis, and al-Qaeda to power in Syria. And why that should be so is beyond my imaginings. But when I read, you know, the columns of people like Krauthammer and Cohen and these other characters and so on, you would assume that, you know, Al-Qaeda sympathizers, of course, something that is, you know, beyond imagining. But we now have a new situation. The Russian offer is an offer that has everything for it, nothing against it, and should be simply accepted.
Well, Edward Luttwak, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Edward Luttwak, who is a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He served as a consultant to the Office of the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Council, the U.S. Department of State, and branches of the military. He's the author of Strategy, The Logic of War and Peace, and his latest book is The Rise of China Versus the Logic of Strategy. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with the award-winning investigative journalist Max Blumenthal, who just visited the vast Syrian refugee camp in Jordan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Ramallah in Palestine is Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His latest article at Mondo Weiss is Shady PR Operatives, Pro-Israel Ties, Anti-Castro Money, Inside the Syrian Opposition's DC Spin Machine. And his forthcoming book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Blumenthal.
Great to be on with you, Ian.
And you've just been in Jordan visiting the Syrian refugee camps. Describe these extraordinary cities. I believe one of them is the fourth largest city now in Jordan, right in the middle of nowhere, sitting on an aquifer, no water, no sewage. It's a monumental problem for the Jordanian government, isn't it?
Well, it's a problem that's partly been created by the Jordanian government or established by the Jordanian government. And I'll get into that, but this is basically an open-air prison for 120,000 people, mostly from the Daraa region of Syria, which is the cradle of the revolution, the Syrian revolution. And it is, as you said, the fourth largest population center in Jordan. It's right on the Syrian border, and it's in a landscape that's starkly reminiscent of the Death Valley. You know, for your L.A. listeners, just imagine sleeping in a tent for 1 year in Death Valley with no toilet, very little water, living on grain, very poor grain and lentils. And that's kind of what these 120,000 people are experiencing. The entire camp is controlled by the Jordanian military. It's surrounded by a heavily militarized perimeter with barbed wire and surveillance. Very few people are able to leave. Most of the people I interviewed had not left the camp since arriving. And now very few people are able to get in. So there are children there that I met, 10 years old, whose mothers can't get in from Syria. And there are tens and tens of thousands of Syrian refugees on the Syrian side of the border, desperate to get in. And the Jordanian military is keeping them out. And the fear among these refugees is that they will, those people waiting on the border are the next to be attacked by Assad.
So what's your understanding of why the Jordanians are being duplicitous about their humanitarian? I mean, what they're putting out is we are the small nation overburdened and we're doing the Lord's work here in humanitarian terms. You're saying there's a certain cynicism here.
Yeah, it's like the Lebanese with the Palestinians. They don't want to integrate them into their society and give them civilian rights. The Jordan's controlled by a Hashemite minority already, and they don't want any more pressure. So they're literally warehousing these people. And when you go in there, I was given permission by the Jordanian government, to their credit, to go in. But it didn't come in time. So I actually sort of snuck into the camp with an experienced journalism professor from Amman who knows the people in the camp. And I was able to get a really unvarnished view of life in the camp because this woman really knew the people. And the conditions they're living in are just abominable, absolutely abominable. And you see the malnutrition in the children. You see that there's no psychological care. The kids are unable to go to school. You walk into a tent, which an entire family of 6 to 10 is sleeping in. You can't stand up in there. And you start asking questions about where they came from in Homs or Daraa. And it's like you're peering into a blood-spattered window into hell when you hear them talk about the massacres that they endured. 90% of the people I interviewed there, out of dozens of people, had survived the massacre, and the majority of them have had family members or neighbors slaughtered in front of them. And now they're sleeping in tents. There's a huge section in the camp of NGOs. In trailers, and there are bathrooms in that section. But when you go into the camp, people have to pay to get these sort of corrugated tin trailers that they refer to as caravans. They have to pay for it, otherwise they're stuck in tents. One old widow I interviewed could not sleep in her tent anymore because she was constantly attacked by snakes. So she went to sleep with another family. And so I interviewed the children of that family, and all they complained to me about was being attacked every night by wild dogs. So there's so much media and so much attention focused on the Zaatari refugee camp, and there are so many NGOs in there, but they can't seem to address any of these basic problems for these people who are basically being warehoused with no hope to return to where they're from.
And Max Blumenthal, you say there are even more people on the Syrian side of the border, just across the border, wanting to get into Jordan. So that would indicate that this is not a fate worse than death, right?
No, I mean, these people escape with their lives, but, you know, I also went to ask them what they thought of the U.S. intervention in Syria, something that I'm staunchly against. I think could be disastrous and could create more refugees waiting on that border. And, you know, we can get into that, but what everyone in this camp wants is the U.S. to hit Syria as hard as possible. I mean, it's understandable. These are traumatized people who have witnessed their families massacred in front of their eyes. That's what they want. And one person told me it was particularly poignant, a man from Homs, whose village witnessed a massacre, he said, of 1,000 people from Shabiha and Syrian army forces. He told me, if you're not going to hit Syria, then hit us, because our life is unbearable here and we're dying every day inside. So that's their attitude. It's a nihilistic attitude, and it's completely uniform throughout the camp. People of all walks of life, although most in the camp are farmers who really want to go back to their land. The only way they see a path to return is through foreign intervention. It's just really unfortunate that, you know, from my perspective, U.S. intervention won't actually give them what they want.
Well, they're not getting what they want and need from the international humanitarian community. This is obviously being run by the UNHCR. So who's not ponying up? You've got all those NGO people living in air conditioning trailers right next to these people who are suffering so much. Is this just a comment on the kind of the realities of international humanitarian activity?
Yeah, absolutely. And just the fact that none of these NGOs are able to put any pressure on the Jordanian government, which is sort of a strategic bulwark for the U.S. between Israel and Syria and Iraq and Saudi Arabia. You know, the U.S. is not going to put any pressure on the Jordanian government. It's the Jordanian military that controls this camp. It's the Jordanian military that's keeping the Syrian refugees out of the camp. It's the Jordanian military that's keeping them on the border. It's the Jordanian military that they say is stealing their passports and preventing them from ever leaving the camp, keeping them basically in an open-air prison. And it's, you know, at the head of this whole thing, it's the great U.S. ally, King Abdullah. This is happening under his watch. So the people there, they don't want better aid. That's not what they were telling me. They want some kind of solution so they can return, so they don't wind up like Palestinians who are living in these camps in perpetuity, if not for eternity. Their wounds are still fresh, and the one thing to them that will heal the wounds is that they can go back over the border. I had one 12-year-old girl tell me that when Assad falls, I'll walk back to my village in Daraa. She was wearing sandals. I said, "You're going to walk with those little sandals?" She said, "I'll walk barefoot." That's the mentality in this camp.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's in Ramallah, Palestine. He's an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and a New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His latest article at Mondo Y says, Shady PR Operatives, Pro-Israel Ties, Anti-Castro Money, Inside the Syrian Opposition's DC Spin Machine. And his forthcoming book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. But the news today that the Russians have run with this offhand remark that Secretary of State Kerry made about that the Syrians, if they allowed international oversight over their chemical arsenals and had them removed and destroyed, then maybe we won't bomb them. And the Russians and the Syrians are running with that idea, and it may well avoid this U.S. impending attack. What would these people in the camps think of the idea that Assad had been let off the hook?
The people in the camps already feel like Assad has been let off the hook because the U.S. has telegraphed its punches and said that the Obama administration has gone to Congress and is waiting so long and going over so many political hurdles. You know, I think I'm glad Obama went to Congress because we can actually have a democratic decision about going to war. But what people in the camp told me was very informed by their own conversations with people back in the villages and towns where they live. One woman from a town called Suleiman, to the east of Homs, I think, told me that the Assad regime has begun moving tanks into the town. And this is a town where they committed massacres in April. I think there was a notorious massacre on April 25th. And the commander came and said, we're going to give you preferable treatment, provide you with services and food if you allow us to keep these tanks here, because then the tanks will be in a residential area that the U.S. won't be able to bomb. And the people in the camp believe that Assad is basically hiding and stashing all of his important field equipment in towns that the Syrian army controls, and that no U.S. strikes will have any effect on his military capacity. And so, therefore, it won't turn the tables in favor of the Free Syrian Army.
But when you say that the young 12-year-old girl with these thin sandals is prepared to walk back across the desert to her hometown of Deraa on the border inside Syria when Assad falls, it doesn't look like Assad's going to fall, does it?
In fact, John Kerry testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that Assad will not fall. And yesterday he said these will be incredibly small attacks. Which means, what does that mean, incredibly small attacks? I've never heard a U.S. leader say something like this before. Are they going to have a flaming paper bag on Assad's doorstep, courtesy of Obama's dog, Bo? I mean, what does this mean? And at the same time, Kerry is saying this is a Munich moment. In other words, Assad is Hitler, but we're going to attack him with incredibly small attacks. So it's really a confusing message coming out of Washington, and the people in the camp are confused. And what they want is punishing airstrikes. One woman told me, bring all our houses down. We accept civilian casualties, and we'll build the houses again. You know, and I don't accept that. I don't think that's going to resolve anything. But that's the attitude of people in the camps who've been traumatized and witnessed their families massacred in front of their eyes.
But this even greater population that you mentioned that's just inside Syria on the border wanting to get out, but the Jordanian army won't let them in to these horrible conditions that the refugees that have escaped are living under, that yeah. If Assad wins, then wouldn't they be massacred or in danger? I mean, they'd be caught between a rock and a hard place, right?
That's such an important question. And when I interviewed the adults, pretty much anyone who was an adolescent or over, they refused to give me their real name or their full name. They would not have their faces photographed. The children are happy to be photographed. They love being photographed. But the adults, if the adults are behind the children, there's some women behind the children, they'll cover their faces with their hijab. That's the level of terror that they're experiencing. They feel like if their names are ever recorded anywhere, that Assad's Mukhabarat will record their name and they'll never be able to go back. And if they go back, they'll be tortured to death. Not just that, but the level of fear in the camp is so intense that many people told me they fear that Assad will attack them with chemical weapons, you know, just to wipe them out as the final blow in his victory tour. I mean, obviously, I don't think there's any basis for saying that. It's just that really speaks to the level of fear that he's managed to instill in this population. I mean, it's incredible. You walk to any part of this camp, the new arrivals section, the older residents were there for 12 or 11 months. And it's just stunning how comprehensive the campaign of violence and massacres Assad was able to carry out was, that everyone there, 120,000 people, has directly experienced a massacre or shelling.
So what's your explanation, Max Blumenthal, for attitudes on the American left, who are much more critical now of the Syrian opposition and keep referring to the al-Nusra front as the jihadis and saying, you know, there was a front page picture on the New York Times the other day of them executing a bunch of captured Syrian soldiers. And, you know, it's pretty obvious that this whole agony in Syria is brought on by the dictator. In the town of Daraa, they rose up. And some teenage boys, I think about 14 or 15, wrote some graffiti on a wall against the divine right of the ruling family, and they were tortured and mutilated in response. And that is how the Assads do business, and they brought this destruction upon this country because they insist that it's their divine right to rule, and it's either the Assad family or the terrorists. And that... I'm astounded that people don't see who really are the people that have brought about this agony and who essentially to this day not only won't take responsibility for what's happening in their own country, but they're prepared to bring the whole place down if indeed their rule is threatened.
The issue is how to end the agony. It's not really a debate anymore about who's responsible. Obviously, I hold Assad responsible. We did an interview, I think, a year ago about my resignation from Al-Akhbar, which is a leftist Lebanese publication. I resigned over the fact that they had slanted their editorials and coverage in favor of Assad. And I believe that he is a brutal criminal who needs to go. There's no way around that. And he's not an anti-imperialist hero. And Hezbollah's activities in Syria have really lowered their credibility in the Arab world. And so I think the issue is how do you end this misery? And the U.S. has done not very little to push on Russia and push on Iran. And Russia and Iran I've seen reports that they're coming up with a counter proposal to a U.S. strike. Which sounds positive. But the issue is a U.S. strike going to do anything to end the misery of these people in Zaatari and the misery of the refugees in the border? And it's just from an objective standpoint. I think it's only going to exacerbate the situation. Obama and Kerry are talking about a symbolic strike. Obama called it a shot across the bow. And that's not anything that's going to change the situation on the ground. If anything, Assad will emerge after U.S. strikes, declare victory, and then increase repression. What I've heard from one person I interviewed from Homs is that detonated dynamite charges have been placed in a central prison in Homs, which is filled with political prisoners, and they're just preparing to detonate at any minute if the U.S. strikes. I've heard that prisoners were moved into sensitive areas that the U.S. might strike. So we're looking at a situation where repression increases, Assad's power is potentially consolidated, and the U.S., if it's judged that the U.S. strike doesn't work in the beginning, it could escalate. It could escalate beyond this incredibly small strike that Kerry promised into something that could last for weeks and cause massive civilian casualties, could involve Iran, could involve Hezbollah. Who knows what could happen? I think that's really where the left is coming from, from its anti-interventionist standpoint. And I'm really, I really sympathize with the third way standpoint that emerged from the Arab left at the beginning of the revolution, which is an anti-Assad, an anti-U.S. intervention perspective that the Syrian people are going to have to be able to demonstrate agency and be the real owners after Assad is gone.
But nothing's going to get rid of Assad. So this looks like evil will triumph. And what would it take to get rid of Assad, short of what, international or unilateral intervention?
Yeah, I mean, I what kind of intervention will get rid of them, and what will come after? Those are serious questions that need to be entertained. And the I don't think Al Nusra is particularly as strong as the left and the anti-war movement is making it out in the U.S., but the Iraqi wing of Al-Qaeda is appearing increasingly at the front lines. And this, the FSA, is, I mean, they're not exactly some heroic figures that I really identify with. But then again, I've always said this, Syrians have a right to take up arms against Assad. He's a criminal. He has to go. But the U.S. doesn't seem to have any clear, coherent plan, and that speaks to the unpopularity of this war. No one really understands what they want when Kerry says there has to be a political solution, and at the same time, they're promising airstrikes.
Well, Max Blumenthal, I thank you for joining us, and we'll have to just do a follow-up because it looks as if there may be a way out if the Russian and the Russian offer may well be accepted, and Assad will live to rule another day, so unfortunately.
I hope this offer is accepted, and there are political forces in Washington that will fight against this, what could potentially be a really reasonable offer. One of those forces is AIPAC, which is not particularly interested in Syria. It's interested in the U.S. attacking Iran on behalf of the Israeli government. It's interested in the U.S. tightening sanctions on Iran. And one of the things that Iran might ask for is a loosening of sanctions, which would be, you know, a completely reasonable proposal to ameliorate the misery of all these people. And so we have to start looking at the forces in Washington that are working against, conciliatory measures. We have to look at the fact that the FSA has rejected dialogue repeatedly, as well as the fact that Bashar Assad is a brutal criminal who has to go. But I think we have to really, as Americans, be most critical about the forces in Washington and our political system that are making it, that are darkening the future of the people I met in the Za'atari refugee camp beyond the level that Assad has.
But these are people, though, that have said to you they want the U.S. to bomb this guy, and they want their own homes blown up. So I just wanted to end up with a coherent message here, because I understand the dilemma of being against U.S. intervention on the one hand, but how do you deal with this evil regime?
You and I have no influence over the outcome of this. The Obama administration's made up its mind, and it's possible that it'll bomb, regardless of what Congress does. And at this point, I mean, you're looking at 190 votes leaning against or against use of force. So they're going to have to make up their mind, and we'll see what happens. It troubles me that it may have reached a situation where it's too late. And it may be too late to do anything beyond diplomacy and some kind of negotiated solution. I thought maybe a year ago or a year and a half ago, the U.S. could have acted or intervened in a way that might have brought Assad down and prevented all these people from leaving. The people in Za'atari camp have left in the last five, most of them have left in the last 5 to 11 months. That was a key period. The Obama administration did nothing then for them. And it's waited till this arbitrary red line was crossed. People were being bombed at bakeries. People were being slaughtered waiting for bread at bakeries. The Obama administration did nothing. And this is another thing that people in the camps find puzzling and people in the U.S. find puzzling. But people in the camps have been reduced to a situation of desperation. They're comprehensively traumatized, and they're willing to accept any possible solution to give them a future, because right now they have none. And, you know, I think I'm staunchly against intervention for my own reasons, but as a journalist, I think their voices have to be heard, and we have to listen to them and put them at the center of the conversation we're having about intervening.
Well, Max Blumenthal, I thank you so much for joining us here from Ramallah in Palestine.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Max Blumenthal, who is in Ramallah, Palestine. He's an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republic and Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His latest article at Mondo Weiss is Shady PR Operatives, Pro-Israel Ties, Anti-Castro Money, Inside the Syrian Opposition's DC Spin Machine. And his forthcoming book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the hearing in the U.S. Court of Appeals on the future of an open internet. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Todd O'Boyle, who's the Program Director at the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. Welcome to Background Briefing, Todd O'Boyle.
Good to be here.
And you were in the court today, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, which is the court directly under the Supreme Court, which is heavily dominated by conservative judges, and the president has not been able to get his appointees on that court. So of the three panel judges today, are they all conservative Republicans?
Well, you have one Reagan appointee, Judge Silberman, and two Clinton appointees, Judges Rogers and Tatel.
Oh, so in this case, there's only one. Silverman is extremely conservative, but the other two are what? Centrist, moderate? Is that how would you describe them?
They're certainly not. I'd say that's fair. Yeah.
So, what was the sense of Verizon's appeal here, where they're basically saying that the FCC shouldn't have a jurisdiction over net neutrality, and that the regulations that the FCC have come up with are excessive, arbitrary, and capricious?
Right. So they had a two-part argument. One part was, as you say, about whether the FCC has authority to enact rules that protect consumers and preserve the open internet, or net neutrality, as it's also known. The other part of their argument was about the First Amendment. And while it didn't get much play during the hearing today, it only came up a couple of times, the Verizon maintains that they have the right to exert what they call editorial control over the communications on their network. And they liken their network to a newspaper and say that we have free speech rights and we have editorial privileges and we should be able to selectively carry or not carry the content that our users want based on our editorial control.
But did anybody point out that in this era of media monopolies like Verizon, Comcast, and Time Warner, that people have little to no choice about what pipeline comes into their house? And if the person who has the privilege of owning this pipeline can start deciding what you want as opposed to what you've been getting in the open internet, how can they make that judgment that they're a newspaper, they're a vital source of information and communication, they are the gatekeepers?
Yes, they absolutely are the gatekeepers, and this is the way we communicate and organize and connect in the 21st century. So anytime we allow these media monoliths to erect toll booths and exercise gatekeeper control on the way that we connect and organize and communicate, it should be giving us all pause for thought. We should all be very concerned about this.
And that's what this ill-defined term net neutrality means, but the consequences are so much greater. The Internet has grown up as a free, an open source of information, and that very character, that very nature of the Internet is what's being threatened in this court case, which I'm astounded that not more people are paying attention to it.
You're absolutely right. And the Internet we have, it's been so transformative in the late 20th and now early 21st century, is a consequence of its openness. It's a consequence of its neutrality. And as soon as you start erecting toll booths and you start giving these big corporations gatekeeper control, you really jeopardize that. And in fact, what we had always suspected, they finally admitted today. By that I mean Verizon. Verizon said, look, we'd like to experiment with ways to, they use fancy terms about, they call it paid prioritization, and they use different euphemisms for it. But they basically said for the first time ever, we are interested in being able to allow or disallow access to certain content on our networks based on who's willing to pay for priority access.
Again, I'm speaking with Todd O'Boyle, the program director at Media and Democracy, at the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. He was in the court, the D.C. Second Circuit Court of Appeals today, hearing Verizon make its arguments as it challenges the FCC's jurisdiction over what is called net neutrality, the open Internet. And this is probably one of the most critical cases to affect the future of America, largely going under the radar. Although, you know, it amazes me, Todd, that so many people use the Internet. I mean, I don't know. I look around me and everybody's staring at their palm with an iPhone. I mean, the extent to which this thing has become ubiquitous is extraordinary. But people don't seem to recognize that the entire nature of it will change once these corporate gatekeepers get their way, and they basically be deciding what they want you to have as opposed to what you want to have.
Precisely. And one of the – you accurately identify this as an untold story or an undertold story. Another undertold story is that the FCC in many ways created this mess on their own accord by years back in the early 2000s. Deeming broadband a so-called quote-unquote information service for the purposes of regulation. If they had maintained its classification as a, quote, telecommunication service, we wouldn't be having this debate. Everyone agrees, and it came up several times today in the courtroom, that if we were dealing with, again, not to get too technical, but if we were dealing with so-called telecommunication services, and the FCC still maintained its classification of broadband internet as a telecommunication service, we wouldn't be. No one would think twice about whether the FCC had the authority, so to protect consumers and promote the open internet. So really, you know, things didn't seem to go well for the FCC today, and I would never deign to predict what the judges will ultimately decide, but. Should these rules be thrown out in part or in whole, the FCC will be at a crossroads and can take another look at whether they have the classification of the Internet right. And if they really care about protecting consumers and promoting a diverse, open Internet that connects all Americans, then they should probably take a good solid look at reclassifying broadband.
Well, it's so obvious that it is like telecommunications. It is like a phone company. The phone company doesn't monitor what you say. Maybe the NSA does, but the phone company doesn't monitor everybody's conversations. They just allow you to use their pipeline for a price. And that is the whole point of the open Internet, is that nobody should be telling you who you communicate with and what you communicate about. And that's why the Internet has flourished.
Absolutely. A good way to think of it is like delivering a letter. If you drop a letter in the mail, like we used to do, you just expect that the Postal Service will get it to its destination, and you trust that it'll get there without it being tampered and opened and manipulated or edited, to use Verizon's term. So that it's not a difficult concept, and we know that it works and that it's a good way to guarantee that people are going to have faith that the content they want to get or that they want to send out will reach its destination. And this is pretty fundamental to the way that we have always communicated.
Well, if the public, they have to wake up soon because this is such a critical case. What more do you need as a wake-up call than what's going on now? With Time Warner in their corporate spat with CBS, where they simply don't give a damn about their own customers, and they just, pull the plug on CBS because over how much they could gouge the customers. And the public don't count to these people. So if Verizon gets the authority that they want, then, look out. They don't care about you. They just care about whatever they can shove down their pipeline to you.
Yes, and we should be, if you look at, mentioning video is a good one, look no further than Netflix. You should be really concerned if Verizon has the ability to degrade Netflix's performance to push its own alternative than some of the services that we've come to really, that we've all come to enjoy on the internet may no longer be available. Similarly, just think about what we might not see. Maybe there's another upstart, and the tech economy has been such a boon and so important.
Right, they'll be stifled before you know about it. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Todd O'Ball. I've been speaking with Todd O'Ball, who's the program director at the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.